Studio 360 is supported by TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com.
This is Studio 360, and I swear I am not Kurt Anderson. My name is Hilton Alves. I spend most of my working time as a writer for The New Yorker magazine, but I'm so pleased to be here with you today on the radio. When I was asked to guest host the show, I immediately started a list of strong creative women at the top of their fields. I knew I had to talk to Toni Morrison, one of America's most brilliant living writers, and my conversation with her is later this hour. But first, I'll talk with actress Candy Alexander. I've been a theater critic, and I still write a lot about theater for The New Yorker. And Candy Alexander is one of those actresses I'll never get over. She's made a career playing characters who are full-bodied, multi-layered, real. On CSI Miami, she played a pathologist who talked to the dead body she was cutting up. On Tremé, she played LaDonna, a bar owner trying to make it in post-Katrina New Orleans. And right now, on Scandal, she's the devious mother of Kerry Washington's Olivia Pope. Devious isn't even the word. She's just hot, but with a vengeance. Candy Alexander has proven herself a master at bringing hard, funny, complicated women to life, and she joins me now. Candy, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Hilton.
I want to play a clip from Tremé. In this scene, your character, LaDonna, as I said, has dinner with her in-laws, and let's just say they don't have the best relationship.
Elsie, darling, I think you left your salad fork in the potato server. You know where I was raised? In the Sixth Ward. We were taught that it was bad manners to correct a guest for their manners. If they picked up the wrong fork or poured beer into the wine glass, we were supposed to do the same.
But in no way would we be treating LaDonna like a guest.
Oh. I'm family. All right, then. Since I'm kin, I ain't gonna pay no never mind how I'm supposed to do. I'm guessing you don't have no malt liquor? Nothing in a 40, huh? Maybe you got a paper bag? So I'm thinking about finishing this here up on the corner.
Tell me how you discovered or made the character of LaDonna real to you.
When I got to New Orleans, I had left CSI Miami, which mm-hmm. was a lot of sheen, a lot of work, because she was a doctor, and Miami's very sexy and big, splashy Bruckheimer show. So mm-hmm. in order for me to find LaDonna, I went through the neighborhood. I got out of the French Quarter. I went down into the guts mm-hmm. of Louisiana, and it's part of my Stella Adler training. I found her. I physically found her. I went looking for her. I took 2 weeks, and I found her. Mm-hmm. And then I followed her. I followed her for several blocks. She went into a little store, bought some stuff. She had a couple kids with her. And once I was absolutely certain this was her, and I knew it was her as soon as I saw her, I really did. I could feel everything, and everything about her, her hair, everything about this woman. And I approached her, and I asked her if I could buy the clothes that she was wearing. I said, I will buy everything you have on. Name your price, mm-hmm. including your earrings, every single thing you have on. I'll pay double for it. And she thought I was kidding, and I said, no. And thankfully, she knew who I was. She recognized me. And I told her what hotel I was staying at because we hadn't shot the pilot yet. Mm-hmm. And I asked her, I said, bring everything you have on to me. And she did. And I paid her for it, and I put her clothes on. So that's how I found her.
Well,
I found her.
Candy, people may know you as an actress, but they may not actually realize that you started out as a dancer. And were featured in some pretty incredible Broadway shows like Dreamgirls. Was it clear to you then that black talent specifically claiming the spotlight was not necessarily standard on Broadway, let alone the movies?
I don't know if that was clear to me, because I seem to have always been in the kind of token role when I was a dancer.
Really?
You know? Yeah, because, you know, I wasn't that black, I wasn't that light. It was like right in the middle. So I was just the perfect token. You know?
Yeah.
Especially when I hit Hollywood as a dancer, it was like perfection. You know, so I worked well with the aesthetic.
You began your Hollywood career dancing, but also working as a choreographer for the great Whitney Houston. And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing the story that I love the most, which is, if I break a sweat, you're fired. Can you explain that?
Well, first of all, Hilton, I cannot even claim to have been in that position were it not for Demeter Jo Freeman.
And tell the people who Demeter Jo was, honey.
So Demeter was the choreographer for the Grammy Awards for Whitney. And we're dancing. She asked me to come with her. She had an assistant, but she wanted me to come as well. We got there. We did the Grammys. And Whitney said, oh, I never worked with dancers before. You guys are so much fun. Come with me. So we went with her, and we had a fabulous time. And through a series of events that I don't really remember, Whitney asked me to step into that position, and I said no. And she said, yeah, and I said, I'm not ready. And she said, well, get ready. So kind of forced the job on me. I was scared to death, and I had great dancers and a great assistant. So I had a lot of help, and I had, of course, the belief of the star of the show. And yes, Whitney did say, if I sweat, you fire. She wanted to walk. She was like, listen, I'm not, you know, at the time you had Janet.
Janet with a dot.
That's right. These were dancer singers. They weren't singer dancers. And yeah. So she didn't sweat.
She wanted to walk and pose.
She wanted to walk. She wanted to do a little bit. But, you know, she liked to walk. So the first thing I did was get rid of all the girls and just put dancing boys around her. Just put some boys up there. Okay, got it. Okay.
What was your impetus to move away from the stage to film and acting?
Hilton, I always wanted and felt like an actress. And that's because of Paula Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would watch Paula Kelly dance. And to me, she danced in character. She was a great actress. I could see her change.
For our fans, Paula Kelly was and is the great black star who was in Sweet Charity with Shirley MacLaine.
I would watch her dance, and I would see her change into a character. And I saw the level of commitment that it wasn't just a dance. She would transform herself. And I liked that. I liked the way it made me feel when I watched her in different performances. And so I always felt like an actress. But I never saw a consistent through line of employment for black actresses. You know, I was a teenager during black exploitation films. So you would see Brenda Sykes, you know, you would see Sheila Frazier, you would see Lynetta McGee, Vanetta McGee. You'd see them, but you didn't see a consistent through line of employment.
Mm-hmm.
And I also noticed that when those films stopped, I didn't see them. Every now and then I would see Judy Pace show up on The Jeffersons or Sanford and Son, but I didn't see a regular check. Okay.
Hey, you a practical girl.
I was like, how are they supporting themselves? You know, like, how does that work? So I thought, I'm going to study. I'm going to study as hard as I can. And I will piece together this career out of theater, film, commercials, you know, when I can. But I wanted to have enough craft. And by that time, I knew about Diana Sands. And I knew that she worked consistently in theater.
Right.
And occasionally had great roles in film and TV. But I saw her consistency in theater. So that's where I really focused was the stage.
You've done theater, you've done movies, but you've also done TV comedies like news radio. And I want to know, what's the difference between how comedy and drama affect your personal life?
I love comedy. But I find that backstage, oftentimes, comics are not necessarily the easiest to work with.
That's right.
They're just not. They're uncomfortable with themselves anyway. Their minds are constantly racing. Like, they're constantly writing as the day is going on. I could see the computer in their heads. So it's a little hard for them to be here now. That's why a lot of times when you spend being in their company, they're always on. What I find with drama is that, you know, the players, the producers, the creators, the writers, they think that it has to be high drama all the time. And so it's like, okay, well, if you have to have this tense, hurtful environment to create art, is it really art?
Right.
So honestly, Hilton, there are trade-offs with both. In my personal life, I prefer comedy because it's easier to shake off.
Well, you certainly make drama look fun when you're on screen, especially in your current role as the beautiful and dangerous mother to Kerry Washington's Olivia Pope on Scandal. I want to play a clip. In this scene, you turn up at a dinner Olivia Pope is having with your ex-husband and her father, Rowan.
Olivia, you lie. In my 22 years in prison, you know what I missed most of all? Really good wine. We always did have that in common.
Enjoy it. It'll be your last.
I heard about your forced retirement. Sorry you lost your little army. Oh, please do, baby. Please take a stab at me. I wonder which one of us is faster.
What are you doing here?
I'm your mother. I love you. I worry about you.
No, you don't.
I do. I know it's hard for you to believe with him in your ear, but I do. I love you. And because I love you, I want to warn you. You need to find yourself another line of work, because what you do now is too dangerous, baby.
Candy, you know what blows my mind about that scene?
What?
When she says, I'm your mother.
You were so funny.
When my sister saw you, she said, you know her? She said, tell her she's doing a good job. She scared the shit out of me.
So. Oh, I love it. Hilton, I have to say this, because you know this, but I don't think anybody else does. I never watch anything I do.
I know
that.
And
you know that. I never, ever, ever. So there are things I've never seen.
Yes.
I'm too critical, and I know exactly what I did. So if they use the wrong take, or if the DP is really poorly lit, or, you know, so many variables that I just have to trust that I did 100% and let it go. Just let it go, because I'll look at it and rip it apart. You know, I can't see it.
Have you noticed or do you feel that the roles for black women have changed on television?
Thank God for Shonda.
Yes.
I mean, just thank God for Shonda. You know, thank God for Betsy Beers. Thank God for Mark Wilding. Thank God for Shondaland. Because I know it doesn't seem out of the ordinary, but it's really outrageously wonderful to look up when you're driving down Sunset Boulevard and see a billboard with Viola Davis on it, and then drive only Viola, singular, and then drive a few blocks further and see a billboard with only Kerry Washington on it? Singular.
That's right.
Now, this is the first time this has happened in my lifetime. And now, there may have been billboards with Diane Carroll, singular, but I don't remember them. I remember her with the boy.
And Lloyd Nolan, honey.
That's right. I do not remember a billboard with Diane Carroll, singular. I may be wrong, but my recollection is that this is huge, and it is wonderful, and it's not a little thing. It's not a little thing for a little black girl to see that. I wish there was some way to let people know how huge it is. I remember being a young girl and watching Lola Falana on these Tigers commercials.
That's right.
It meant
Fabergé.
Everything to me. It meant everything to see those boy dancers and Lola in that commercial. It was everything. It gave me hope. It let me know there was room for me, that I was special, you know? But that's why Shondaland, you know, I wish I'm looking forward to this catching on. I'm looking forward to both of those shows making so much money and getting so many viewers that it can no longer be denied that that should be normal.
Candy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Hilton.
The new season of Scandal just started, and next spring Candy's featured alongside Queen Latifah in a new biopic about legendary blues singer Bessie Smith. Candy Kane, I'll call you later.
Okay.
I love you, I'll call you later.
I love you, Hilton.
Still ahead this hour, Thelma Golden. She's one of the more significant figures on today's contemporary art scene, but she started off looking for images of strong black women on television.
When I think of the influence that stands with me, it was Roxy Roker's portrayal of Helen Willis on The Jeffersons.
That George Jefferson makes me so mad.
George makes everybody mad.
I'm Hilton Al, sitting in today for Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Please stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
This is Studio 360, and I am not Kurt Anderson. I'm Hilton Owls, I swear. I got to know Thelma Golden more than 20 years ago when I worked on the catalog for an exhibition called Black Male, Representations of Masculinity in Contemporary Art. Thelma was the curator of that Whitney Museum show, and it was a game changer for how people talked about race and art. Some years later, her exhibition Freestyle turned out to be just as influential. She's not the kind of curator who just hangs art. She uses it to help us see the world in new ways. Thelma Golden is now the director and chief curator of the Studio Museum, the Harlem institution that has been presenting artists of color for 50 years. Thelma, thanks for stopping by Studio 360.
Hilton, thank you.
Tell me something about the Studio Museum. What are the goals, and how did the museum come about?
The Studio Museum in Harlem was founded in 1968. And when the museum was founded, it was with the very important premise that there should be a museum devoted to presenting the work of black artists.
Mm-hmm.
The founders of the museum were brilliant because in our name, they created the mission.
Mm-hmm.
So the studio represents the fact that the museum has always had an artist-in-residence program, always had artists working in the building, and have always been committed to living artists and their process.
I see.
Museum, of course, was the real challenge to the art world,
mm-hmm.
that the Studio Museum was saying, we are going to create a museum to create and reinvent and re-envision the canon to include the work of artists of African descent. And Harlem was a way to signal that this institution would be rooted in this community, which, of course, was the home of the Harlem Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1968, when we were founded, a community that was reinventing itself. So that's what the museum was and was founded, but it's also what we remain, committed to artists, committed to, you know, radical presentation in a museum, and committed to being in and of Harlem.
And how did you find your way back to Harlem? I know your father is a native of Harlem.
My grandparents came to Harlem in the early decade of the century from Jamaica. They married in Harlem, and then my father was born there. He was raised by his mother. My paternal grandfather passed away, but my paternal grandmother brought her mother from Jamaica. So my father was raised by these two incredible women and was educated in Harlem, the public schools of Harlem, then went to City College. But he is a real son of Harlem, loved Harlem. He and my mother married in the early 60s and moved to Southeast Queens. Coming into Manhattan, as we did often, my father, though an incredibly thrifty man, he would take the then Triborough, now RFK Bridge, though it had a toll, because it meant we got off on 125th Street. And so that every trip into Manhattan would include a ride through Harlem. And so I grew up sort of knowing the neighborhood.
Tell me about your father's business before he retired.
My father was a lawyer, but worked. His business was as an insurance broker, property and casualty insurance broker. And through much of my adolescence, I worked for my father in his office. And it was probably best for his clients not to know that it was his 16-year-old or 15-year-old daughter answering the telephone.
Yes.
Though it was a solo business, his name was Arthur Golden. It was called Golden and Golden Insurance. And so I would pick up the phone and I'd say, Golden and Golden Insurance, how may I help you? And I was very, very good at it. My father loved the television show Mary Tyler Moore. And he instilled that in me. We watched that together. And it was an example of a professional woman, a fully actualized professional woman.
On her own, doing it on her own.
And I know that was a gift that he gave me. But it was also from that that I gained my sense of, you know, what this professionalism might sound or look like. So really, when I answered the phone, it was essentially in a Mary Tyler Moore voice. That's what I was trying to do most of the time.
That's very funny. And one of the things that I know was very important for your parents was to expose you and your brother to a great deal of cultural life in the city. So when you're talking about Harlem here, I hear that they exposed you to living history.
Of course, you know, my parents were deeply invested in culture, deeply invested in African-American culture. They love music. They love the theater. They love literature. So many of the pieces of what have become my life.
Yes.
Were there. And my parents didn't censor. I mean, I saw many things that clearly I would not have understood fully. But what I understood was the feeling of it.
That's right.
So all of my fantasies as a young person of what being an intellectual, cultural producer could be came from these encounters, these real encounters, you know, the television encounters. You know, when I think of the influence that stands with me, it was Roxy Roker's portrayal of Helen Willis on The Jeffersons.
That's right.
Do you remember Helen Willis?
Yes, I do.
Do you remember that apartment?
Yes.
The dark walls,
yes.
The African sculpture.
Yes.
Do you remember the way in which they were always going off to the theater, off to Lincoln Center as they came down?
That's right.
Right? To Louise and George's on the way?
Yes.
Those are the things that, you know, for me gave me this sense of what would be possible.
That's really amazing. So I wanted to ask you, what was it about museums that appealed to you? What made you see the museum as a place you could contribute to?
I always loved museums. Mm-hmm. I loved museums from the time I went to museums for field trips as a child in school. And also, at the point that my parents allowed me to begin to take the subway by myself. Now, you know, remember, this is, you know, late 70s, 80s New York City, right?
Yeah.
So taking the subway by yourself, that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finally could take the subway by myself, the places that were most welcoming, most accessible, most open, had most potential for me as a young person were museums. So I just spent hours and hours walking through museums, picking up every free brochure, buying postcards in the gift shop, reading wall labels. I would walk around museums and guards in museums,
yes,
primarily middle-aged African-American men, surprised but often sometimes thrilled to see me mm-hmm. there walking on mm-hmm. my own, would often point out things to me. And they were guides to me in those institutions. But it wasn't until I saw an article in The New York Times about Lowry Stokes Sims, who mm-hmm. was a curator of 20th century art at the Metropolitan Museum, and I saw a picture of Lowry, that I then was able to fully understand and realize that there was someone who made
a person of color.
Well, and or
a woman
just
of color.
A woman of color, but also someone in general who made those
a real
choices.
Person. Yes,
that
yes, yes.
Put those things
yes.
on the wall, right?
That's right?
That they didn't grow out of the walls themselves. That someone did that. That's when I decided that I wanted to be a curator. I wanted to work in museums. I wanted to work with artists and with works of art. I wanted to spend all of my life doing that.
Did you ever want to be an artist yourself?
I never wanted to be an artist, and I think it is because my experiences of viewing art were always, for me, combined of not just what I was seeing, but where and how I was seeing it, mm-hmm. that I was immediately attracted to the idea of being involved with what it would mean to present work. So, no, I wasn't an artist. I had an amazing art teacher, and she, you know, taught art with the idea of just the joy of making. And mm-hmm. I think certainly I have that, and I continue to have that, the joy of making. Mm-hmm. But never, ever, ever thought I might be an artist. I never imagined that would be possible.
When you became a curator on the staff at the Whitney Museum of Art, were you the first curator of color there?
I was, to all recorded history. Now, I've always wanted and hoped that somebody would come forward and say that, no, you weren't. You are wrong.
Right.
You know, but actually, I was. And I, it's a role.
This is not, I'm not putting the institution down
no,
at
that's
all.
No, that was yeah. the world and the museum world. And so I was very proud when I got a job in 1991 at the Whitney. I felt an incredible amount of responsibility. You mm-hmm. know, I walked in that door every day with the sense of what it meant. Mm-hmm. I knew that I was existing with an incredible amount of privilege mm-hmm. in that position, and that I had to use that privilege to get work done.
Mm-hmm. And did it, you did. You got blackmail done. It was a groundbreaking show. How did that idea for that show come to you?
The exhibition came out of my desire to make an exhibition that looked at the ways in which contemporary artists had looked at images of black masculinity, particularly through the media, from the late 60s to the present. But how the show really happened really has to do with the fact that David Ross, mm-hmm. who was director of the Whitney at that time, mm-hmm. who hired me as a curator, encouraged what became the curatorial vision in me that made that show possible.
Right.
You know, another great inspiration for me was Dorothy Miller, you know, mm-hmm. the pioneering curator who'd worked at the Museum of Modern Art.
Mm-hmm.
And as a curator, I knew I wanted to have that kind of voice, the voice of a curator who looks at their moment and makes exhibitions that positions artists and their artworks as a way to speak about it.
Right.
And blackmail, that exhibition came out of artists. It came out of the fact that I was sort of raised as a curator by a fierce group of artists.
Yes.
You know, those artists who really demanded of me that I understand what their work was about, and as a curator, begin to create the spaces that it could occupy.
What's changed for black artists since the late 80s when you started your career?
A lot has changed in the art world since the late 80s. You know, I can remember, as I'm sure you do,
mm-hmm.
In those days, the way in which we thought about presentation, the way in which we thought about representation, was sort of conditioned by every event being singular, right? Because not
right.
so much happened.
Right.
So that each
of this is the black show.
Right.
This is, yes.
So things were seen as singular, and that had been going on for many years even before that. I think what's changed now is this incredibly wider field
mm-hmm.
in which black art is presented. Now, I will be the first one to say that I still want more. I want to see more. But I think what has changed most significantly is just the widening and the opening of the space.
Mm-hmm.
It is this amazingly wide open feel.
Thelma Golden, thank you so much for joining us today at Studio 360. It's been a dream and a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thelma Golden is the director of the Studio Museum in Harlem. You can find out more about some of her exhibitions at studio360.org. In a moment, Toni Morrison explains that if you can't find the books you want to read, you have to write them yourself.
I wanted to read a book about the most vulnerable person in society, female, child, black. And it wasn't around, so I started writing it.
I'm Hilton Ells, in today for Kurt Anderson on Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Please stay with us. Hi, this is Studio 360, and I'm Hilton Ells. Kurt Anderson is taking a break, and he'll be back next week. When they asked me to come on the show, I felt it was essential to talk to Toni Morrison, whose 10 novels have won her the Pulitzer Prize, Nobel Prize, and Presidential Medal of Freedom, among many other honors. Born in 1931, Toni continues to share her thoughts on life and literature. We met at her home, where the walls are partly decorated with beautiful large paintings by her late son, Slade.
Oh, yeah, he was so good. Most of the other ones I have in my bedroom, there's one in there called Mavis's Chair.
From Paradise?
Yes.
Yes, yes.
And he has one in there that's right by my bed. It's called The Wound. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, just paint, but it has a slash of red surrounded by black and so on. Mm-hmm. But he was, you know, wildly inventive.
You said you love the light in this apartment.
Yeah, very much, yeah.
And so when you wake up to work, are you looking for that light, too?
Yeah, yeah. Recently, I've been sleeping a little late, like 7:30.
That's late for you, because you're up at 4 usually.
I get up before the light. I want to be there when it... mm-hmm. So that's depending on the season. And then I can work. I'm really smart in the morning, you know. You caught me at the edge.
Yeah.
I'm slowing down now, getting dumb and stupid and forgetting.
But you still work in the morning.
Oh, very much so. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Depending, is it a fixed schedule or is it...
I don't do it every day.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not there every day. When I get the first draft, I can work every day. Because
it's something to work
yeah,
on.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Right. So, but when I'm still, you know, moving it, I started something about a month ago. I have no idea where it came from, but it's infectious. And this kid says, I put the cup on the windowsill to catch the blood. I can't talk. But I hear everything. Everything. He's sort of... I am excited not only about whatever that plot is, which I think I know about now,
mm-hmm.
but I am so excited about writing from the point of view of a mute who can hear.
Oh, wow.
I am the voice.
When I first discovered Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, I was 17... and it knocked me for a loop. The protagonist reminded me of my father, a black man of some privilege. Recently, I reread Song of Solomon, and I was struck by the friendship between the two male characters, called Milkman and Guitar. That deep affection between the two men is something I feel had been missing in literature before Toni wrote it down, and I wanted to know where that came from.
The impetus really was that my father died.
Mm-hmm.
And I had decided to write a story sort of in the area of the pre-civil rights movement. And I thought, I don't know a thing about these men.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I knew what my father knew.
Mm-hmm.
And when I said that, I thought that. There was this feeling of serenity and confidence and competence, mm-hmm. as though I knew he would let me know. So, of course, we had no conversation between the living and the dead. But that serenity that I felt, that I could enter into that world with confidence, happened after I asked that question.
Can you tell us a little bit about your father?
Yeah, he was born in Georgia, Cartersville, Georgia. And although I never knew it while he was alive, why he left, mm-hmm. I knew he was about 14 years old when he left. But he had seen two black men, businessmen, lynched on his street, hanging from trees. So he left. He had a half-brother in California. And then he came where many people were coming, Lorain, Ohio, which was a steel town. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of work there. Mm-hmm. Married my mother. Worked at sometimes three jobs, you know, washing cars and doing this and that. Until, in fact, the war came. Mm-hmm. A lot of black men and older men got jobs in these factories that probably they would not have before. And I remember the day he got the job and told my mother what the salary was. I think it was $50. Mm-hmm. And she kicked off her shoes. We were in heaven. And that feeling of doing good work, he came home one day and said to me, he was at that time a welder at the shipyards. And he said, today I made the perfect seam on the ship. He said it was so perfect that I signed my initials at the bottom. And I said, but Daddy, nobody's going to see it. And he said, but I know it's there. Mm-hmm. And it made such an impression on me about his perfection in work, mm-hmm. his sense of not display, but just doing first-rate work, mm-hmm. good enough for him, mm-hmm. not for the ship or other people, but mm-hmm. his own ideals of what good work was. And that was the satisfaction of his life and most of the men I knew.
There's another amazing story that I read a while back about when you were a teenager and you were cleaning house for this lady, and you said you told your father that the work was hard and the lady was mean. And your father said,
go to work, get your money, and come on home. You don't live there. You live here. Boom. Separation. I have never had an employment problem since.
But one of the things that makes me love both of those stories is that he's telling you that there are limits and heights that you can reach.
And how valuable I am, or he was, as a human being.
Right.
Beautiful work. Mine. It's beautiful work. It's a perfect scene. Mm-hmm. Somebody doesn't like you at work. It's not about you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are doing work over there. Your value is that you live here.
Yes.
It's not what somebody's calling you names or saying you don't. The lady was right, you know. I did not know what I was doing. I had never seen a vacuum cleaner before. A stove that complicated, you know.
Yes.
She said, clean the stove. I cleaned the stove, but I forgot the oven.
Right.
So I can't blame her. She
That's
was fussing.
Funny.
But my feelings were hurt.
He yes.
just taking all that out.
Yes.
Go to work. Do your work.
Once you were on the other side of being a daughter with your father and so on, and you then were a mother to your boys, the idea of safety, of keeping your boys safe, how did black masculinity look to you then, when you were then responsible for these boys in the way your father had been responsible for you? Did you feel the same kind of protectiveness that your father felt toward you and more because you were
I felt frightened.
Alone. Frightened.
Frightened of what could happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being in a house that we were living in then, and looking out the window at night, mm-hmm. hoping to see my son come down the road, because mm-hmm. he was late. I felt I wasn't strong, spiritually, intellectually, but I thought if something happened, you know.
Physically, what could you do?
Physically, what could I do? Every summer, they went home to my parents and my father and my mother and their cousins. Mm-hmm. So they spent a lot of time in that milieu, mm-hmm. you know, with all kinds of males, which probably helped them. But I always felt a sense of regret that I couldn't be two people. Still feel it.
Still really?
Oh, yeah. Big time.
One of the things that I loved when I looked at the photograph of the woman who wrote Song of Solomon, when I bought that book, I think it was $16 maybe? Something, $12.95 or something.
Long ago.
$12.95. And I remember I had $20 for the week. And I said, that's the week.
Oh.
And I looked at the photo and I said, but I know her. You were every woman I knew in my life who, single mother.
Oh, yes, yes.
Had a job. Had this other life. One of the things that you said during that period in an interview about Song of Solomon was that you never imagined growing up being a writer. You wanted to grow up to be a grown up, an adult. They always knew you were smart in your family. Was there any indication at all that you would be a creator of books yourself?
No. They thought, and I thought, that I would teach school. I was 39 years old when I published The Bluest Eye, and it took me 5 years to put it together because I really was very eager to read it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to read a book about the most vulnerable person in society, mm-hmm. female, child, black.
Mm-hmm.
They're always jokes. They never hold the stage. And I also wanted to write a book about a time when it hurt, racism, and what were the consequences of it,
mm-hmm.
to take her seriously. But I wanted to read that book,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't around, so I started writing it in bits and pieces, rewriting it, and then I joined a writer's club and so on and so on. But it was the impulse to know, to imagine, to have a book like that somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I found that when I finished that book, I went very deep into a sadness, and I realized that I don't really like it around here if I don't have something to write.
Mm-hmm. Something to imagine.
Yeah, but to be in this other, my other free imaginative place.
In the years after The Bluest Eye, Toni was recognized as one of the great novelists of our time. When I think of some of the canonical black writers before her, such as James Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, and Richard Wright, I see a big difference in the way Toni imagines male characters. Her men love, and often are loved in return. And that's not something I see in the works of those male writers.
I don't know, this sounds sort of sexist, but I think...
why not?
Why not?
Yeah.
I think the male writers feel isolated, mm-hmm. feel separate, feel different. I think the women writers don't. I feel very strongly connected to friends or community. I never felt cut off from, even when I was far away.
Mm-hmm.
I felt other people and a life in a community or on a street or in a house,
mm-hmm.
even though we used to live in many places. Being evicted rather constantly, you get an idea of mm-hmm. what home really means.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's exactly true, but I always felt like with Invisible Man, I'd love that book, Invisible Man, but the title says it all. It says, Invisible to Whom? not to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even when I noticed the rape scenes, for example, in Ralph Ellison, it's terrible, but there is somehow in the language a sense of power, accomplishment. So when I do the rape scene in The Bluest Eye,
mm-hmm.
I use very feminine language, very supple, unproud language. Because what he's doing is not even about her. It's about his
memory.
Own, the memory of failure.
Yes, yes.
Of his own, you know, as a kid.
Yes.
So, you know, it's, I refer to it sometimes as sort of invisible ink where you do not the overt, you know, when I was trying to make the reader happy, comfortable, cheerful, when in home,
mm-hmm.
I just removed all the color.
Yes.
From every place he wasn't, you know, on his way, so that it was so welcoming. And he surprises him. Were these trees always this green?
Right.
And then, you know, trying to find out what color the sun would be mm-hmm. at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
Here lies a man. So I decided tomato. Mm-hmm. Tomato red would be the color I would end with. It would mm-hmm. be blood and fruit and nourishment at the end.
When you received the National Medal of Freedom from President Obama, how did you feel receiving it from him and being in that space?
I felt glorious. There was a certain amount of joy and glory receiving it from him.
Mm-hmm.
And he, because I was in a wheelchair, sort of. I mean, mm-hmm. I wasn't walking very well. He held his hand out, and I took it and pulled me up. And there was this feeling, I don't know how this can be interpreted, but the relationship, not relationship, the aura was as though I was standing next to an older brother. He's, you know, half my age. But if you could understand what that's...
I do know
an older
mean.
Brother.
Yes. He had looked out for you.
Yeah, he not gonna hurt me.
Yes. Now that President Obama is coming toward the end of his term, second term, the hope and enormous support that you gave him, does that still exist? And how do you see his career really continuing?
I think he's one of the best presidents. And I start with FDR. I'm born in 1931, so mm-hmm. 32. Different times, different challenges, the world is entirely different.
I always had an intellectual crush on FDR.
Yes.
Yes.
Indeed.
Yes.
So there's this, I think the legacy is extraordinary. And part of the extraordinariness of it is not just his own brilliance in thinking far ahead,
mm-hmm.
is the madness and a real lunacy and fear that the other party or other groups of people have had. I have never, ever seen anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I am a stronger supporter of his now that I have seen what he has come up against
mm-hmm.
than I was in the beginning when I just thought he was flawless mm-hmm. as a president, not as a human being, obviously, but his work. But now that I've seen the trouble and the flood of vitriol and hatred and lies and...
and he's cool.
And he's still cool.
Yes. So you're working on a new book?
Yeah, I turned in a book.
Yay! That's great news.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Well...
No, it's... I love it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very different from things I've done before.
Would you like to talk about your new book at all?
No.
Okay.
Shut up and get out.
What the audience doesn't know is that before you guys tuned in, Tony and I were laughing about... she said that she was very happy to be 80 years old because there were three things that she could say now and not worry about it. One was no, the other one was shut up, and the other was get out. Thanks again, Tony.
You're welcome. It was lovely.
Lovely. The wise and wonderful Toni Morrison. Her new book is Home, and we'll find out about that next book sometime soon, I hope. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. I'm Hilton Owls. It's been a pleasure joining you, and Kurt Anderson will be back for next week's show. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramasvaram,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Pinnamaneni,
Krista Ripple,
Zoe Azule,
Amira Nader,
Scott Ross.
Special thanks to WNYC's Chris Bannon. The theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, David Fincher, the director of Fight Club and Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, who makes a dark, violent thriller like nobody else.
It's completely lascivious and merciless and tastefully done.
David Fincher on his new film, Gone Girl. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.